Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, the last podcast I think that we did together, because I was off from the podcast last week, was...
And then I was off before that.
And you were off before that, was a bit about Iran and Top Gun. And since then, both you and I separately have seen the movie. It was great, no?
I really loved it. And you know what? It feels like something different, right? Today, like, action movies are all about, like, superheroes, magic, space. And I enjoy all those things, don't get me wrong. But this just felt like something different that, like, we haven't seen in a long time. And it was really well done.
It was really well done. It was very cool because we had spoken about how it seemed like they're going after an Iranian nuclear reactor. They don't mention who the enemy is at any point, except that it's an enemy with a nuclear reactor. And it's in a place with snow-capped mountains.
I think Iran does have snow in the winter, I'm pretty sure.
Does it have snow? But,
yeah. And also the other thing is that the quote-unquote bad guys were flying MiGs. And they didn't call them MiGs the whole movie. They just kept saying, like, fifth-generation aircraft.
Yeah.
Which I found, like, they were being very careful. And I think it's because they wanted to sell this movie wherever they can all over the world.
Right. They can sell it to China because it's Iran. They can sell it to Iran because the bad guy's China. They can sell it to Russia because the bad guy's someone else. So everyone gets to watch the movie.
Right. But they couldn't sell it to China in the end because China decided it was too, like, patriotically American.
Mm. Well, I'm not one to talk too much about China these days. But when it comes to this government is collapsing, Lahav.
I don't belong to any of the blocs, neither the pro-BB or anti-BB bloc. I've got the ability and leverage to form a stable right-wing government that'll represent the majority of Israelis, which are right of center, but they also want change.
I was thinking about this yesterday. We have a prime minister right now, Naftali Bennett, who represents 4 seats in the Knesset. 4. That's nothing. That's like a statistical error.
Herb Kanin wrote an analysis, maybe it was last weekend or the weekend before, that there's like a legitimacy gap of this government. That even if they've lasted a year and they've managed to govern, you know, and opinions can differ at how good they've been at it, but they've managed, that Bennett never really had legitimacy. Like, he started out with 7 seats, which were, I guess, really 6 because Shikli dropped out right away. And people just kind of can't get over the fact that you can't really run a government with that many seats. And it just, you're not the person that the voters chose. And I do think that that is at the core of a lot of his problems.
In other words, it's not just because of the right left together. It's not because of the Arab participation. It stems from the fact that this is, he just doesn't have the public support. The prime minister, the leader of the country needs to have, I think, and that's, I was thinking about this also, when people talk about how the experiment has failed. So everyone seems to think it's talking about the participation of the Ram Islamic Party in the coalition. And there might be lessons that need to be learned from that. For example, do you have an Arab party that is part of the core 61 that you need to pass votes? Or do you have 61 and then you have an Arab party that comes on top of that so that they don't have to vote for things that they can't vote for, and that, you know, and then it doesn't turn off their own constituents, but also doesn't turn off your constituents because you're not dependent on them for every single vote. But I think the experiment here is also having a prime minister with so little public support, right? That's an experiment that might have failed.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's just been a challenge for him at every juncture, right? Like, he can't assert himself as much as he would like to in the coalition. And, you know, just to give the example of, like, the Palestinians and how this government relates to the Palestinians. So, no, there's no negotiations with the Palestinians for a Palestinian state, which, you know, in theory, just like it happened to Yitzhak Rabin, like, someone could have gone behind his back and done it. But the fact that no one went behind his back, honestly, I think speaks more to the actual situation with the Palestinians than it does his political situation. But at the same time, you had all these senior ministers going and meeting with their Palestinian counterparts and meeting with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, even though Bennett very openly expressed his disapproval. But he's like, well, I can't put my foot down. Now, how important is it that they actually met with Abbas? You know, it's debatable, but I think it's sort of symbolic of the fact that they are taking actions that go against the government's stated policy, you know, and they're just flaunting it, and he has no say.
You know, when we think about Bennett, though, for a moment, it's obviously premature. It's difficult to know exactly when this government will fall apart, but I think everyone seems to see it as being a sinking ship, and it's on its way down. The fact is, everybody's jumped ship from his office, pretty much, and his own party, and with the Judean Samaria bill, the countdown to the end of the month, and that was, you spoke about that last week with Tamar Beiri and Yisrael Gantz, the head of the Binyamin Regional Council. So that's what Nir Orbach, the member of Yamina who stepped away from the coalition this week, that was kind of his flag. And it's a legitimate right-wing issue, right? You could have 500,000 people who live over the Green Line who might be thrown into a state of anarchy.
I don't even think it's necessarily a right-wing issue, right? Even if you're someone who thinks that, like, eventually, you know, they all need to be evacuated, or many of them need to be evacuated, like, they're citizens, they should have the right to vote, or they should, we should be able to get taxes from them, or they should be able to go to the hospital, you know.
100%. But from Orbach's perspective, it's a legitimate right-wing hill, so-called, to die on, right? If that's what he would bring the government down. But if you had to predict, Lahav, and I know it's putting you on the edge here, but what does Bennett do? Does he have a future in Israeli politics?
I don't know. It's a tough question. I mean, his party in the latest poll that came out as the night before we recorded this only got 5 seats as opposed to the 7 it got in the last election, which is not great at all, and not a position from which he's been a pretty strong negotiator at times in the past. So maybe he can negotiate his way to a senior position, but I think he's going to be.
Yeah, but 5 is on the that's just at the electoral threshold. 5,
of course. I mean, and we know that in 2019 he didn't even pass the threshold in the first election of that year. So, you know, he definitely is at risk here. He might be coming to the end of his political career right after being prime minister, but definitely being prime minister is not giving him a boost.
Which, if you think about it, that itself is pretty incredible, right? Because think about the prime minister. Prime minister, every speech he gives, broadcast, national media, right? Every tweet becomes a headline. He can get an interview or go on TV or on the radio whenever he would like, right? You get exposure and covered for, in terms of media space, what's worth tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in a campaign kind of way of thinking, right? And that hasn't served him at all, right? And maybe it's because there's been this very strong campaign against him led by Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud, calling him this nochel, right? This con man, or the guy who stole the government.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to this sense of that he's not legitimate. You know, that on the right, even though he comes from the right, they view him as having stolen that position, quote unquote, and that he's just an opportunist who's acting for his own, you know, to be boosted to his own highest position. And on the left, they're like, okay, if this is what we have to do to get rid of Bibi, fine. But it's not like, you know, they think that he's such a wonderful prime minister. So, you know, he's tried to create this niche of, he's tried, and so has Justice Minister Gideon Saar, and maybe to a lesser extent, Finance Minister Avigdor Lieberman. They've tried to create this niche of, like, right wing, but not Bibi. And while you know and I know plenty of people who are like that, anecdotes make bad data, and it turns out that there's just not that many people, and that's not a position that sort of justifies being prime minister from an electoral respect.
Because the votes aren't there. I mean, you look, you know, you mentioned the poll that you said where he only got 5 seats. Netanyahu got 36 seats in that poll, right? I mean, Netanyahu, with everything stacked up against him, is strong. And that's pretty impressive. Yeah. And that's impressive.
And not just is Netanyahu stronger, but the Religious Zionist Party, which at the moment includes, on its own, it's a very right-wing party, but it also includes Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's, you know, a disciple of Rabbi Meir Kahana, who was banned from the Knesset for being racist and sort of continues in that vein to this day. They jumped up to 10 seats in this poll, and it's not the first poll, I think, where they have 10 seats. So I think that the attempt to put together a more liberal right-wing camp somehow hardened a lot of the right instead of the opposite.
On the note of Ben-Gvir, Lahav, a lot of people will tell you Israel has turned to the right, I get that all the time. I'm sure you get that from people you talk to. And they say, you know, look at the rise of Ben-Gvir, look at how strong Netanyahu is, look at all of these different things. My answer always is something along the lines of, and tell me what you think, that you have to make a distinction between two different categories. There's security, where I think, yes, Israel has turned to the right, and that stems from something I think that should be very obvious to people, is years of terrorist attacks and thousands of rockets and attempts to reach out a hand in peace to the Palestinians to only be rejected and met by intransigence all time after time. And again, more terrorist attacks and more terrorist attacks. And just until recently, terrorist attacks. So that, yeah, that will make you right wing when it comes to security. But I think what's interesting, especially this month, as the world marks Pride Month, is how when you look at social issues, Israel has kind of even turned a bit to the left, I would say. Right? I mean, you have pride parades. Just as one example, people will say I'm pinkwashing for a moment. But in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, of course, but pretty much in all cities across the country, but even on other issues, social welfare, how do we divide up money between those who have and those who don't, more government intervention and when it comes to the housing crisis, this country has become a little more less capitalist in that way, it has turned a bit to the left, no?
I don't know that the country's becoming less capitalist. I do think that there is definitely public opinion in favor of freeing up a lot of the markets in this country that are really tied up in unions that like have all kinds of red tape. But I do think that it's the most of the country is socially liberal. And that's what Pride Month tells us. That's what, you know, the fact that fewer and fewer Israelis are going to the chief rabbinate to get married, even if they find a rabbi that they like and they want a Jewish wedding. Like, fewer of them are actually going to the chief rabbinate. You know, I think it's becoming socially liberal in a lot of ways. I don't think it's becoming woke, which...
God forbid, please no.
Personally, I know. Although, occasionally, I'll see something in, like, Haaretz where I'm like, please don't import this annoying rhetoric from America. But overall, that's not what I think is happening. But I do think that there is greater acceptance of sort of diversity and variety in society.
And as we know, when Israel adopts something from America, it takes it all the way to the extreme. So if wokeness starts to come here, we might have to cancel this podcast because I don't know if we'll be able to say certain things anymore, right?
I'm not worried about it at the moment, but you never know. We have to be vigilant. But, you know, at the same time as I think overall Israel is a socially liberal society in many ways, I do think that in the sectors of society that are conservative, or at least the Jewish sectors, the Haredi sector and the religious Zionist sector, there's kind of a backlash. And, you know, another part of the religious Zionist party is the Noam party, which is explicitly an anti-gay party. I mean, they don't call it, they say they're for normal families, but like basically they believe that there's like a gay agenda to like brainwash the children of Israel. And that's what they ran on.
Can I tell you something about the word normal? So yes. I think it was after the second
it's
election.
Their word, yes.
Not no, mine. I know. So after the second election, we were home one night at dinner, and my older kids were asking me about the elections, why we keep on going to more elections. And I said, you know, this is ridiculous already. We just need to have a normal party. Someone needs to set up a normal party of just normal people, right? Who just want to take the country and do good things for the country. And one of my daughters, the 15-year-old, looks at me and says, Abba, who are you to decide what's normal? And I said to them, no, you know what I mean, just normal people. And they're like, no, again, who are you to decide what is a normal person? And it's amazing what you learn from your kids, but it's so true, right? I mean, who am I to decide what's normal? But you know what I meant. I meant just people who care about the country, normal people.
Honestly, like I think a decade ago when Yair Lapid founded Yesh Atid, that's what he was trying to do.
Right.
He brought in all people who are not politicians from different sectors of society, people who had founded all kinds of organizations that were doing all kinds of amazing things. It really, he has an impressive roster of people. It's just a question if you agree with their policies and what they've done with it, right? That's at the end of the day, a lot of people come to the Knesset with like an impressive background and they care about the country. And then the politics sort of, they get stuck in the mud.
It's impossible to get things done. It's a very difficult system. One other issue is that also connects politics together with the Jewish world is the Jewish Agency. Right. The Jewish Agency has been fighting for about a year now to find someone to replace Isaac Herzog, who was elected president, and to serve as the chairman of the Jewish Agency. They have a committee of 10. You need 9 votes. They haven't been able to find someone. Seems that the leading
candidate... basically, they need unanimity because there's one vote that's basically going to Dani Danone no matter what. Yaakov Chagoel, who's the head of the World Zionist Organization and is now... and is on that committee, you never know, but he's basically committed to voting for Dani Danone, who is not going to get 8 other votes. So it's like a weird situation where they need to convince everyone but this one guy.
100%. And the leading candidate right now seems to be Doron Almog, right? Doron Almog is a former general who was commander of the Southern Command, winner of the Israel Prize, lighter of an Independence Day torch, has done a lot for the country, and in recent years was the founder of Alei Negev, right, which is a rehabilitation center down south in the Negev Desert. It's named for his son, Eran, who was a disabled child and passed away a number of years ago, already when he was in his teen years. But it really, he made that shift from the military guy to being this person who founded an amazing rehabilitation center, a social activist, and has really had a huge impact on the country. He seems to be the leading candidate.
And just to explain, because I think maybe people don't understand, it's they like created a village for like young adults who have severe either physical or mental impairments so that they could have a social life and they could have jobs and they could have easily accessible medical services. It's like a really beautiful thing that he founded.
But you pointed out something interesting about Doron Almog, you reminded me, and that was?
There is a warrant for his arrest in the UK for war crimes, alleged war crimes, I would say.
Well, there was back a number of years ago. I mean, is it still standing? We don't know.
As far as I can tell, it is.
It is.
I couldn't find anything that said it wasn't.
And basically, so people remember, is that a number of years ago, Doron Almog was on an airplane on his way to London, when he gets a phone call or the security officer on the LL flight comes up to him and says, he was no longer in the army, but he says, you know, retired General Almog, you can't get off the plane because there are cops, British policemen waiting outside the gate to arrest you when you step into British soil. So by staying on the LL flight, he was as if still in Israeli territory. He just stayed on the plane until it turned around and went back to Israel.
Yeah, that'll be a pretty crazy situation. I mean, the head of the Jewish Agency is like it's sort of independent from government, but at the same time they're treated as like a very high level Israeli dignitary. Years ago when this situation happened with Tzipi Livni and she was justice minister, I know that somehow the UK got it canceled, because what they have is they have something called like universal jurisdiction, where first of all they can charge people with war crimes who had nothing to do with England. And then also people who live in the UK can like petition for these charges. So I'm not sure exactly how Tzipi Livni's was canceled, but maybe that's what would happen if he was voted in. And also, I'm not sure how much time the head of the Jewish Agency actually spends in the UK normally. I think these days they're much more focused on the former Soviet Union, and probably the main fundraising is in the US.
Yeah, it could be. But, you know, maybe one less place that I'll have to go fly to. Someone else will have to make that trip to London. Lahav, this week we have an interview with Gabriel Mitchell, who is a energy expert from the Mitvim Institute of Foreign Policy and also teaches at a Notre Dame campus in South Jerusalem, which we'll hear a bit about because I found that part to be interesting. Of course, gas is also interesting, but you and I also wrote pieces for this weekend's Jerusalem Post magazine about the energy opportunity that Israel finds itself currently in with its huge reservoirs of natural gas, and how it could potentially help alleviate the crisis that Europe finds itself in with no longer being able to take Russian gas. So there's a lot going on in the energy sector, gas, with Gabriel Mitchell, and you'll read it either in print or online in the Jerusalem Post.
So we're here with Gabrielle Mitchell, who is a policy fellow at the Mitovim Institute and the director of undergraduate studies at the University of Notre Dame at Tantur, which is their campus in Jerusalem. We'll talk about that later. But we brought Gabi on the show because he is an expert in energy policy, and there is a lot going on with energy just in the past couple weeks here in Israel. So thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So as we're speaking, the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, is in Israel meeting with the whole top echelon of government, as well as Energy Minister Karine Alarar. And in all of her public statements, she's been focusing on energy. So can you sum up for our readers, why has energy become such a big thing right now for EU-Israel relations?
Absolutely. Everything about the EU-Israel energy conversation goes back to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the European Union's challenge, both in engaging with a long-standing diplomatic dispute with Russia over natural gas prices that have now been exacerbated by a conflict in Europe itself. There have been numerous discussions over the last couple of months within the European Union about how to respond to the Russian invasion. And one of the decisions that's been made has been to cut itself off as much as is humanly possible of Russian natural gas and oil. Now, this is an enormous challenge. The European Union, as of last year, imported about 150 billion cubic meters from Russia, which is somewhere around 40 to 45% of its annual consumption of natural gas. So the challenge for the European Union is to replace Russian natural gas, not only in the near term, but in the long term, in order to offset what it doesn't want to be consuming. It doesn't want to be dependent on Russian natural gas anymore. And so the European Union has gone on a massive campaign and quest to replace Russian natural gas. There are a couple of different ways of doing that. First is to essentially continue the policies that the European Union has adopted over the last couple of years, which is to transition from fossil fuels to renewables. And the European Union is going to ramp up those efforts. But it's important to just remind everyone that that transition is a long-term strategy, and that at the very least for the medium term, fossil fuels are still going to be a part of our lives. It's still going to be a part of the European Union's reality. And so it's trying to find alternative sources, both from the United States, from North Africa, from Qatar, from all over the world. Also, at least in theory, from here as well, both in Israel and the Eastern Mediterranean. At large.
As much as I'd like to talk about Ursula von der Leyen, if that's how to pronounce her name, but I'm just stuck still on how difficult it must be to be named Ursula after The Little Mermaid came out, you know, a bunch of years ago. But we don't have to talk about that. I am curious, though. President Biden made an announcement a couple months ago that the United States would give 15 BCM, right, billion cubic meters of natural gas to Europe, right, to kind of fill that gap, right? That's not a tremendous amount, right? When you're considering that 150 BCM is what Europe, the EU, was getting from Russia. So what was that 15 BCM really meant to do when Biden said that he would give it?
So the 15 BCM was essentially meant to first, on a diplomatic level, demonstrate the fact that the United States was supporting the European Union and supporting the European Union policy. It's the equivalent to essentially, you know, the U.S. saying we're going to put in our share and we expect our partners around the world to put in their share as well. It's very challenging, right? Because if you look at the global market, right, the global LNG market, liquefied natural gas, it's only at only about 530 BCM a year, right? And so a large portion of that was already going to the European Union, about 20%. And the challenge for not only for the European Union, but let's say also for the United States that's trying to support the EU's efforts, is that most of the natural gas in the world is far afield from the European Union. And so you need to convert it into a liquefied form in order to deliver it via ship to the European market. So the pipeline system that one would ideally like to already be connected to the European Union from other parts of the world will take years to do. And Europe doesn't have years. It has months, right? We're in the month of June. By December, January, the European Union is going to be faced with another winter when natural gas prices and natural gas demand typically increases. And we're already on the brink, potentially, of a global recession. And so these are the kinds of factors that are at play. Now, I will give the Biden administration credit. Putting down 15 BCM is not a small amount. And the administration is trying to encourage American companies to ramp up their production and contracts with European countries. But of course, there's this push and pull that exists throughout the West, in Europe, in the United States, elsewhere, of, on the one hand, this commitment to a transition to renewables, but on the other hand, a conflict in Europe that necessitates a complete restructuring of the global natural gas market. And how do you do both of those things simultaneously without having a serious, sharp increase in global energy prices, and as a result, economic stagnation, recession, inflation?
And we sort of saw this issue come up in Israel, right? Where earlier this year, El Arar announced that Israel would stop gas exploration for the year. And then after the war in Ukraine and after increased interest in buying natural gas from Israel, she's reversed that decision. So where do you think, I mean, you talked, you know, about gas being this sort of like transitional energy source. Like, how do you think Israel should be planning ahead for use of its natural gas resources, both domestically and for export?
So Israel's been in a really interesting situation for the better part of a decade where, offshore natural gas reserves were discovered. Overnight, Israel went from being energy poor to having almost too much energy. But one can never have too much energy. But in other words, Israel's domestic demand was limited and it needed to find export routes to sell off surplus gas in order to make these investments affordable and worthwhile for developers. So Israel's done a good job of trying to find local or regional contracts in order to both expand domestic reliance on natural gas in terms of transportation, transitioning from coal to natural gas, et cetera. There's much more that it can do, but there's a ceiling on the domestic market. And that's the reason why Israel signed export contracts to Jordan, which is also a fairly small market, but more importantly to Egypt. And Egypt not only is a large market, 90 million people, large natural gas demand, but also Egypt has two liquefied natural gas facilities. In other words, large pieces of infrastructure that can convert natural gas to liquefied natural gas and then sell it on the global market. And those contracts are some of the most important for Israel because it enables Israel to sell surplus natural gas to the global market. And if Egypt wants to use it for domestic consumption, in theory, it also can.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though.
Yeah.
So we have right now two pipes, basically, that provide or transport gas from our gas fields to Egypt. One goes, correct, one is underwater, and one goes through, is above ground, that goes through the Jordanian depot, yeah, so-called, and then crosses over into Egypt. But there's now talk of a third pipe to up capacity. Correct. But whatever we do here in Israel, yes, and you know, I go back to the 15 BCM that Biden made a promise, because Israel probably, with the amounts of gas that it has in Leviathan and Karish that's coming online it's expected in the next few months, with the floating rig that has arrived there just a couple weeks ago, Israel can up its capacity, mm-hmm, of how much gas it can extract, and it could probably provide numbers that I've heard, and tell me if I'm wrong, anywhere from 10 BCM and upwards on an annual basis to the European market. That's a big amount, but that's not anything that's going to happen at least this coming winter, right? So just tell me if how wrong am I what I just said, and make some clarity.
No, you're absolutely correct. At this point, the existing infrastructure enables Israel at maximum capacity to export somewhere in the range of 10 to 12 BCM to Egypt, and that can then be converted, right? But Egypt's existing terminals can only convert somewhere around 16 to 17 BCM annually. So far this year, it sold about 5 BCM to the global market. A lot of that has gone to Europe, but most of it has actually gone to Turkey and elsewhere, right? So once again, you have to get the pricing right in order for it to still be competitive enough for European countries to be interested in purchasing that natural gas. And there's a bottleneck, right? Israel could up its production, but it still would need to go through Egypt, and Egypt has limited capacity. Limited is all relative. 17 BCM annually is impressive. And there are efforts to expand its capacity in the near term, but anything beyond that is going to take time. Constructing LNG facilities takes time. Investing in floating LNG facilities, for the sake of example, you had mentioned the Karish field. The Karish field will be developed by a floating LNG terminal, in other words, a vessel. But bringing other vessels online will take a number of years. In fact, the earliest expected date of a floating LNG vessel to be on the market and available is 2026. So you're dealing with competing timelines with a global energy market that right now is in crisis. But by 2026, will it be in crisis? We don't really know, right? We don't know when the conflict in Ukraine is going to end. We don't know what the future of Russian exports into the global market is going to look like, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're an international energy company and you're trying to make investments, you have a very difficult time to determine what kind of investments are going to be worthwhile, both in the short, medium, and long term. Mm-hmm. So Israel's in a bit of a bind, right? On the one hand, it can up its production, and I anticipate that by the end of the month, Israel and Egypt and the European Union will sign an agreement that gets the right price for Israeli and Egyptian natural gas to be exported to Europe. But in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to alleviate all of Europe's needs.
And also contrary to what a lot of people think, right, laying a pipe from the Mediterranean to Europe is not that simple, right? It's huge.
No, I mean, that's going to take years, but that's not what they're talking about right now.
Yeah. No, they're talking correct. About the short term is the Egyptian
option.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And anything that's longer than short term raises a lot of questions, right? Today, Van der Leyen is in Israel. She's a politician. She'll meet with Israeli politicians and Egyptian politicians. But the bottom line is that you need the commercial actors to be on board. And right now, the biggest commercial actor in the Eastern Mediterranean, Chevron, hasn't really been committed or interested in making large investments in infrastructure. They're willing to work with the existing infrastructure, maybe invest in a secondary pipeline between Israel and Egypt, but you're still working with the existing framework of Israeli natural gas ending up in Egypt and being converted into LNG. They're not pursuing some of these larger infrastructure projects because the medium to long term is so uncertain and the investments are quite significant. East Med pipeline, which has been spoken about for well over a decade, has never seen a penny of investment.
We should just tell our listeners who might not know that the East Med pipeline was a plan to be the longest pipeline in the world, mostly under the sea, from Israel to Cyprus and then Greece.
And that would be an estimated, depending on, you know, the conservative estimates were $7 billion. The more exaggerated estimates, maybe around $10 billion, but it's a serious investment over a very long maritime space that includes both geopolitical disputes, technical issues, and of course, commercial feasibility issues. By the time that natural gas arrived in Europe, would it actually be affordable? Would Europeans be interested in buying it? And so even today, under the existing crisis, we're not seeing a real effort to revive that pipeline. And that speaks to the massive hurdles and challenges that some of these large infrastructure projects face even today. So the options are limited. I think that, you know, Israel is doing the right thing in order to be supportive of its partners in the European Union and in the West more broadly as it tries to alleviate its dependency on Russian natural gas. But there is only so much Israel can do in this set of circumstances. Some of the other options that are available to Israel aren't in the, necessarily in the area of natural gas, but other forms of energy and other types of cooperation that Israel can engage in with the European Union. I anticipate that to also increase in the coming years.
So I want to just go back to natural gas, though. And we talked about the East Med. So now relations between Israel and Turkey are sort of warming up. And Turkey keeps talking about possibilities of a pipeline. It doesn't seem like that's going anywhere in Israel. But what do you think of that option?
So if there were no geopolitical issues in the Eastern Mediterranean, there would already be a pipeline between Israel and Turkey. Turkey is one of the largest markets in the region. Also a population of 90 plus million with enormous energy demands and very limited domestic resources. Turkey is also interconnected already with the existing regional energy network and systems, basically operating as a conduit for both oil and natural gas that's coming both from the Caucasus and the Middle East to Europe. So Turkey, if we were to wipe away all of the geopolitical issues, would be the natural location, not only for Israel's natural gas, but likely for most of the region's natural gas. However, we can't ignore the geopolitical disputes, not only between Israel and Turkey, some of whom have not been resolved up until this point, but also between Turkey and other actors, notably between Turkey and Cyprus. And any pipeline between Israel and Turkey would have to go through Cyprus's waters. It was a very skeptical proposition several years ago when Turkey and Israel discussed it. It's even more dubious today because over the last 10 years, Israel's relationship with Cyprus has only become more and more meaningful, not only with Cyprus, but also with Greece. And Cyprus is a member of the European Union. So I think that when we talk about the proposition of a pipeline between Israel and Turkey, how willing is the European Union willing to go to sacrifice other European Union members for the sake of acquiring a relatively small, significant quantity of natural gas? So that's the reason why I think that any kind of talk about an Israel-Turkey pipeline is kind of, you know, pie in the sky. You can't separate the geopolitical issues from all of the commercial and the economic issues. And up until this point, it doesn't seem like Cyprus or Greece or anyone in the European Union is willing to make these sacrifices for the sake of Eastern Mediterranean natural gas.
The best case scenario is for this war to just end, right? For Europe, at least, because if the war is over, they can go back to getting gas from Russia.
Yes. Obviously, everybody wants the conflict to end. I do think that there are many voices in Europe who have seized the opportunity of Russia's invasion of Ukraine to remind everyone else that they've been advocating for reducing dependency on Russian oil and natural gas for quite some time. That's not only a European position or a position that exists within Europe, but it's been an American position for decades, that Europe is overly dependent on Russian natural gas and oil, and it needed to diversify both the sources of natural gas and oil around the world, but also transition to renewables. And so even if there is a resolution to the conflict today, I think that Europe's pursuit of diversification is going to continue, and its transition to renewables is going to continue. And
Everyone wants renewables, is, yeah. Right? But it takes time. The world is just not yet there. I think that's
it'll take at least a decade. at least a decade, if not more, right? And the technology only supports so much of those investments. Hopefully there will be new technological innovations in the coming years. But the bottom line is that, you know, Europe is still going to be dependent, and the global economy is still going to be dependent on fossil fuels in the medium term.
And gas is better than coal in that sense.
Absolutely, right? It's all relative. If you were to talk to somebody who's advocating from a green organization, they would tell you gas is also bad. And yes, you know, gas has a carbon impact, just like other fossil fuels. But relatively speaking, it is cleaner than coal.
So when this comes out, it'll be almost 2 weeks since Energean started trying to pump gas out of the Karish Reservoir, which is sort of across from Haifa. And immediately after that happened, the president of Lebanon made a furious statement about it, saying that it is encroaching on Lebanese territory. What is happening there?
Yeah, so Israel and Lebanon have had a outstanding dispute over their maritime boundary for the better part of a decade. There have been numerous attempts, mostly mediated by the United States. The Biden administration has tried, but both the Trump and the Obama administration have tried in the past as well, to essentially delineate where the maritime boundary is. Now, the position of the two parties about a year and a half ago, when they were last negotiating, was over what is called Line 23. And Line 23 is north of the Karish Field. So Karish Field was not in dispute. But during the course of those mediated talks, the Lebanese party decided to take a maximalist approach and decided to shift the line from Line 23 to Line 29, which then included the Karish Field. Now, that was a breaking point for the Israeli party, parties who were negotiating, as well as for the United States that was mediating the negotiations, because it was a reversal of past Lebanese positions. And so talks fell off. What is happening now is that, you know, the Lebanese government, which is trying to navigate a very serious economic crisis with severe electricity shortages, has seized on the opportunity of Energean's floating LNG facility arriving at Karish Field to essentially use a little bit of leverage, make a couple of threats, and maybe get back to the negotiating table. So I don't think that anybody was seriously taking those threats, but it was enough to bring U.S. Special Envoy Amos Hochstein to Beirut and to negotiate with the Lebanese side and to see whether there's any possibility of making progress. Now, what I've heard is that that the Lebanese position had already softened by the time Mr. Hochstein arrived in Beirut, to some variation of the original line 23, with maybe a little bit of an addition here and there to incorporate a prospective field that Lebanon hopes maybe one day to attract international investors to go and to develop called Kana Field. But essentially, it would enable Energean to develop Karish Field and to set this issue to bed. So that's essentially the current situation. Obviously, Mr. Hochstein, after meeting with officials in Beirut, will go and talk to Israeli officials as well and see whether there's any opportunity for some kind of negotiated process. But I would say we should keep our expectations low because Israel and Lebanon don't recognize one another diplomatically. Negotiating with Lebanon is particularly tricky because of the internal politics in Lebanon, and of course the fact that Hezbollah has an outsized voice in Lebanese politics and anything pertaining to Israel. But at the very least, that's the process.
You know, Nasrallah recently said he doesn't want any Hochstein or anybody named Steen negotiating with Lebanon. So not even accepting the U.S. negotiator, who happens to be a I think he gave up his Israeli citizenship in order to serve in high-level government positions in the U.S., but he was born and raised in Israel, and Hezbollah does not like that that's the person running these negotiations.
It's a catchy line, but obviously Hezbollah and Lebanon have no choice as to who is the negotiator and mediator representing the United States. Mr. Hochstein is the, you know, not the first one who's tried to bridge the gaps between the two sides. He may not be the last, but in terms of his expertise and his familiarity with the parties, there are very few people in this administration or in the United States writ large who have a better understanding of the issues, the nuances of the two sides. And so my assumption is that if the United States is unable to bridge the gap now, it might be unbridgeable, which would be a loss for both parties, but certainly a more significant loss for Lebanon, which has tried and failed over and over and over again to attract foreign investors to explore and drill in its waters.
So, Gabriel, I wanted to ask you, in just a turn for a moment, to Notre Dame. You work there. But you're not in Indiana. You're in Jerusalem. So explain to us how this legendary team is legendary college, sorry, university with a legendary football team. They have a campus in Jerusalem.
Yeah. So the University of Notre Dame, for listeners who are familiar or unfamiliar, is a American Catholic university based in South Bend, Indiana. Most American listeners would probably be familiar with the name because of its football team. And maybe they've seen the movie Rudy. The University of Notre Dame has essentially been responsible for managing a property in the southern portion of Jerusalem called Tantur. Tantur is a location that basically sits between the neighborhoods of Gilo, Beit Tzfafa, and Bethlehem. It's a hill, and on the top of that hill, there is a campus. And since the 1970s, Notre Dame has managed this property, which is technically owned by the Vatican. And for the better part of the last 50 years, the campus was used for ecumenical studies, which is a fancy word for saying engagement between Catholics and other branches of Christianity in order to better improve the dialogue between various Christian sects. The University of Notre Dame has been managing it, and over the last couple of years has made a decision to increase its profile on the campus, both offering the opportunity for its undergraduate and graduate students to engage in academic studies and research here, as well as signing agreements for research and partnership both with Israeli and Palestinian institutes.
Well, I just think what's cool is that you've solved a mystery, I think, at least for me and a lot of other people who live in Jerusalem and drive by there. So if you're coming down what's known as Hebron Road, Derech Hebron, and you're going towards Gilo, and you get to the end and you take a right as if you're going towards the Gush Etzion tunnels. So to all our listeners who have taken that road hundreds of times, just up is that massive campus, big walls around it, lots of land. No one ever knew what was behind there. Looked like some mysterious Christian something or other. We just got that mystery solved. So just for that, Gabriel Mitchell, it was worth having you on the podcast.
My pleasure. And anyone who's interested in visiting can and is welcome to. We actually held an event just a few weeks ago that included Ambassador Nides. And so we're in the process of kind of trying to find ways to collaborate and cooperate with the local ecosystem that'll draw more people to this campus, which is stunningly beautiful. You know, just in terms of secret Jerusalem, this is definitely up there on the list of secret Jerusalem, but we would prefer it not to be a secret. So, please, if you're interested in visiting, you have an open invitation.
All right. Well, that sounds great. Thank you so much, Gabriel Mitchell, for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be here next week, like every week. And if you enjoyed it, please send it to your friends and family and give us a high rating on Apple Podcasts.